Welcome to the FDD Events Podcast. I'm Cliff Mate, founder and president of FDD, and pleased to share with you the following conversation. Please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast so you don't miss out on future FDD events.
Good morning. It's Monday, April 1st, April Fool's Day. The war in the Middle East is now 178 days old. I'm Jonathan Shanzer, Senior Vice President for Research at Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Welcome back to the FDD Morning Brief. I continue to get calls, emails, texts, WhatsApps, and other forms of messaging about this little program of ours. Most of it is positive feedback, although a few have been critical, and that's okay. We're happy to hear all of it here at the FDD Morning Brief. So fire away. Tell us what you think. Our only objective is to provide you with the news and analysis you need to start your day three times a week, no more, no less. This morning, we'll have Aaron McLean on the program. Aaron is a former Marine. He was an advisor to Senator Tom Cotton on foreign affairs. He's the host of an excellent podcast called School of War, and he just happens to be a senior fellow at FDD. We'll chat with him live shortly. There's a bunch of things in the news today. We are hearing about the Iraq militias that have fired at a lot. There's some news coming out of Turkey, the elections, lots of things we could talk about. But right now, I want to talk about Palestinian reform. Reports suggest that the Palestinian Authority may be close to ending the program that we call Pay for Slay. This is the PA's longstanding practice of bankrolling jailed terrorists with Israeli blood on their hands. The PA pays the families of dead terrorists as well. As I like to say, this is social security for psychopaths. Before October 7th, the U.S. envoy to the Palestinians, Hadi Amr, was close to getting a deal done. The war derailed him. But now, as the White House plans for the day after in Gaza, the need for a legitimate government is urgent. Abu Mazen, the corrupt autocrat who rules the West Bank, is eager to spike pay for slay if it means that he can take back Gaza. He lost that territory to Hamas back in 2007 when the Palestinians engaged in their civil war. This is a legacy thing for the old man. Whatever Abu Mazen's motivation, ending pay for slay is a good thing. But let's be clear, ending this is not reform. It's the bare minimum. The State Department on Friday praised Abu Mazen for nominating a new reform government. Newsflash, installing new officials doesn't constitute reform either, especially if Abu Mazen remains president. The guy is 19 years into a four-year term. Foggy Bottom hopes the new government will deliver, quote, results for the Palestinian people in both the West Bank and Gaza and establish the conditions for stability in the broader region, end quote. Really? I'd settle for a PA that doesn't fund terrorists or line their own pockets with U.S. taxpayer dollars. As for Gaza, how about letting Israel finish off Hamas before we talk about stability in the broader region? Now for your headlines. Headline one, Yoav Gallant, Israel's defense minister, says that captured Hamas operatives admit that the terror group is collapsing. This is not surprising. No terror group can handle the kind of beating Hamas has taken without it taking a toll. Some 12 or 13,000 fighters have been killed in this war. Some 10,000 have been injured, and another 3,000 or 4,000 have been captured from what we can tell. I'm obviously aware of the reports suggesting that Israel underestimated the total number of Hamas fighters at the start of this battle. Hamas certainly could have had more than 30,000 on 10/7, but no matter what the total was, the number is undeniably smaller. Rafah, we all know it. That's where the majority are likely hiding underground right now, waiting for the big battle that looms, four battalions. Whatever the battle comes, it's a safe bet that Hamas's numbers will dwindle even further. So don't buy for a second that Israel is losing this war. The only question really is, when will the U.S. give them the green light to win? Headline two, unrest has rocked Jordan in recent days. There have been multiple nights of protests, and then there was the Molotov cocktails that radicals were throwing at police while they set fire to dumpsters in a so-called refugee camp in Amman. This is obviously alarming because Jordan is a crucial piece of the U.S.-led alliance system in the Middle East. But sadly, this is not surprising. The Jordanian king, the queen, the foreign minister, and others in this government have been out there spouting the same sort of extremist rhetoric that we hear from the likes of Iran and Hamas. Did they not think that this would have an impact on the population? I'm not saying that the Jordanian people, who are perhaps 85% Palestinian, were going to be calm and collected during this war, but the tone at the top matters. And in this respect, the Hashemite kingdom has stumbled mightily, I'm sad to say. And headline three, Politics in Israel are heating up. The post-10/7 unity among Israelis is starting to fray. Tens of thousands came out to the Knesset, Israel's parliament, yesterday. They are demanding that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu step down and allow for elections, and they plan to keep this up for 4 days straight. I support Israel's lively democracy, and I also believe that Netanyahu must sooner rather than later allow Israel's voters to decide his fate. He presided over an historic intelligence and military failure on 10/7. But I'm also worried. These kinds of protests were the norm for more than 10 months in the lead up to the 10/7 attacks. I believe they emboldened Hamas as well as the Iranian regime to attack. They gave the impression that Israel was weak and divided, and Netanyahu inevitably had to briefly hand over power to Deputy Prime Minister Yariv Levin last night in order to undergo a hernia operation. This at least is showing that the transfer of power is still something that's possible in Israel. Now, I'm pleased to introduce Aaron McLean. Aaron fought for our country as a Marine officer. He served our country again as an advisor to Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas. He has a terrific podcast called School of War, and he's one of those people who you find reading ancient Greek history on a long flight to Saudi Arabia because he thinks that's fun. He's a brilliant guy with keen military insights, and we're proud to call him a senior fellow at FDD. Welcome, Aaron McLean.
John, thank you so much for having me. The tables are turned. I'm used to being the one on the interviewer side of this, but we'll have some fun.
All right, good. Well, let's see how you do here on the other side of the mic. I'm going to start by asking you just a very basic question. You heard my take, but it may not be yours. Is Israel winning this war tactically, strategically, war of ideas? You name it. Break it down for us.
I agree with what you said. If we understand the question at the operational level of war in Gaza with respect to Hamas. So you just laid out certain sort of layer that we could talk about this at. If you think of the war that has been waged against Hamas from October to the present, there's no way to say that Israel hasn't made substantial operational gains and is on the verge of a strategic victory or defeat of Hamas in Gaza. That's a remarkable turn of events. If you had asked me back in October, would Israel still be engaged in major combat operations in Gaza in April? I would have said, no, of course not. There are various clocks that are going to run out on Israel before then, whether it's an Israeli political clock, whether it's a clock of American tolerance, the notion that, you know, 6 months in, Israel could still be prosecuting its campaign, which is the time frame that something like this was probably going to require. I would have been astonished. And yet here we are. Hamas does appear to be on the ropes. Their future as an entity that can control Gaza politically, that can maneuver as a sort of semi-conventional military force. All of these things are in question, and I think Israel stands a good chance of resolving that question favorably for itself. If you step back, though, and connect what's going on in Gaza and what is going on in the Israel-Hamas war specifically with the broader regional conflict, and you start to try to assess how is Israel doing with respect to its competition with Iran, I think the picture gets a little murkier.
So, okay, let's talk about Iran then. The regime seems to be giving the Israelis and the United States a run for our money. We always seem to disaggregate their proxy wars against the United States or Israel from their strategic vision for the region, that goal of hegemony. How do you think the Iranians are faring right now overall?
Well, let me answer that question by engaging in a little bit of a thought experiment about what the Iranian theory of victory actually looks like to them. I think you're absolutely right. Something like Iranian hegemony, regional hegemony is clearly a goal. And I'm going to offer for purpose of conversation, you're welcome to reject this, though I don't think you will, that when the Iranians say they seek the destruction of the state of Israel, they mean it. And that is actually their strategic goal. But what does that actually mean? What does a serious Iranian planner in Tehran imagine that looking like, considering that Israel has a nuclear deterrent? Reported, considering that Israel is a wealthy country with an effective military, it seems unlikely, and it seems to me that it would seem to an Iranian planner to be unlikely that the anti-Israel axis is going to get online with military forces and drive Israel into the sea. There's no iteration where that seems particularly realistic. So what does it mean? What does it mean to destroy Israel? I think what it means in more realistic terms would be to generate a series of circumstances and conditions where Israel is poorer, weaker, and a less attractive place for Jews to live, where the Zionist project, starts to take on water, if you will. And I think if you start thinking about it that way, you can imagine a way of understanding what Hamas has done and the consequences that have followed from it as putting Israel in real risk, let's say in greater risk of a future that looks like that. Right now, I mentioned a few minutes ago an American political clock that was always going to be ticking for major ground operations in Gaza. There have been moments where it seems like the Israelis will face this terrible choice of defeating Hamas, which seems like a strategic and political imperative for Israel on the one hand, and maintaining American support on the other hand. They've been able to put off this dilemma. I think it's in their interest to continue to put it off as long as they possibly can. It looks like they're in the process of putting it off right now. But if they were ever actually to face that choice meaningfully and really become more autarkic in their war-making capacity, really start to downgrade the relationship with the United States, diversify their relationships, that is a major step away from Israeli grand strategy for the last generation or two more. And you could see a kind of Israel evolving out of those strategic choices that is an Israel that is a little bit more on the right, a little bit more oriented towards its military, an Israel that maybe is a little bit less attractive to the kind of capital that has fueled the startup nation, which is the economic dimension of this Israeli grand strategy. And if I'm an Iranian looking at the effects of 10-7, an Iranian strategic planner for the regime, to be clear, it's not clear to me that we're losing. It seems to me that there are some open questions here. And then when it comes to the Iran-US competition, I think it's actually not murky at all. I think Iran is making real progress against the United States in the region.
Well, I think certainly on the U.S. side, I think you get a sense that we're making deals on the side with the regime. I have to say, though, just looking at the war with Hamas, you know, we used to talk about Hamas as a tactical threat. And I think that they have proven otherwise, that they have actually posed a strategic threat to Israel. And we're watching that. I think you've described it accurately. But let's talk for a minute about the U.S. They're making progress. The Iranians are making progress vis-a-vis the U.S. They seem to be undermining our position. But are we still the big dog in the Middle East? Are we holding our alliance structure together? And I think maybe the bigger question is, can we still leave the Middle East? Should we leave the Middle East? These are questions that seem to just pop up every couple of months, and no one seems to have the right answer. It doesn't look like we're leaving anytime soon, even though we might want to.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't, it doesn't. And I mean that in a specific way, in the sense that we haven't left the Middle East. U.S. Central Command exists. It is pretty well resourced with some pretty high-end systems and manpower. And yet, we don't seem to be generating the kind of stability, the kind of fear in our adversaries and confidence in our friends that you would think such an investment ought to return. And that's because this administration, the Biden administration, seems to assess that a war with Iran and a broader regional war at a high order is the thing to be avoided. And their strategic goal is to avoid that war. And because our adversaries know that our strategic goal is to avoid a broader conflict and avoid a clash with Iran, that gives them a lot of room for troublemaking and maneuver. And when I say troublemaking, I mean closing the Red Sea to the vast majority of commercial traffic. That's a pretty big deal. And I'm not going to say we never talk, here at FDD, we talk about it a lot, but it is astonishing to me the way in which that is only marginally in the headlines. It is extraordinary that the Islamic Republic, via its ragtag band of proxies in Yemen, has achieved a geopolitically significant development like that, and that the United States appears to be powerless to reverse it. Instead, we have very significant naval assets in the Red Sea, you know, essentially playing defense with Houthi attacks on our ships and on shipping in general. That is a sign that deterrence is failing. And I do fear, and this is a longstanding debate amongst those of us who talk about international politics a lot, about the nature of credibility, the nature of deterrence. There's obviously a major debate in the United States, as you point out, about what the value of our involvement in the Middle East is. I would argue that deterrence in international politics is a little bit like crime policy at home. Criminals don't start acting out because they realize there's no police officer on every corner. Criminals start acting out, as we see in American cities today, because they have a belief that they're going to get away with it, that the laws aren't going to be enforced, that there's a general spirit of lawlessness that takes hold. And there is a general spirit of lawlessness that is descending on the world. And this is not a 2024 thing. This is a process that has been underway at least for a decade. And the Middle East, this is the bizarre thing. And my direct answer to your question is, even though we haven't left the Middle East, you know, what would the difference be if we did? I mean, there would be some, but much less dramatic than I think we deserve.
Yeah. And I mean, I have to say, you know, to your point about the Red Sea, if you had told me 6 months ago that we were going to witness the shutting down of the Red Sea and something like 12% of the world's maritime trade would be choked off, you know, routes from Asia to Europe for energy being shut down, this would seem like the moment that the U.S. would get very active and push back as hard as humanly possible. And I think obviously the election coming up later this year is weighing heavily on the president's decision-making as commander in chief. That's my take, but certainly that sense of lawlessness is clear to me. So in light of that, let me ask you to zoom out. You study the history of war. That's your thing. So when I look around the world with war in the Middle East and on the edge of Europe, and with trouble brewing in Taiwan and a bunch of other smaller conflicts flaring up here and there, I wonder what you see. I mean, many people say, and I hear this all the time, on social media for sure, people say this looks like the 1930s. I'm betting you see some similarities there, but are there other historical analogs that you can point to that look like this moment?
It's a great question. And I think, you know, the two big 20th century examples, of course, are the lead up to World War I and the lead up to World War II. And the reason why I think a lot of people suggest that this looks like the lead up to World War II is, one, the global nature of the disorder that is breaking out, as you point out. You know, every major Eurasian theater currently has major instability. There's war in two of them, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and obviously what's happening in Gaza, and then just Israel's conflict with its with Iranian proxies more broadly. So the global character makes it look a bit like the 30s, but so does the fact that there is a general expectation that something terrible is coming. And that's one of the major distinctions between the lead up to World War I and the lead up to World War II. In 1913, 14, European policy elites and leaders certainly knew that they were running huge risks. Certainly knew that a war was possible, didn't necessarily know how bad the war was going to be. But the public at large was less prepared and certainly had very little idea of the kind of events that would then dominate 1914, 15, 16, and so on. That wasn't true in the late 30s. In the late 30s, it was generally expected that something terrible was going to happen. That Hitler was probably going to keep going in some fashion. Much of 1939 was spent discussing when Hitler was going to invade Poland. And in that respect, it does feel a bit like the 30s today. But I'll add two things, two differences. The first of which I think is very concerning is that in the late 30s, early 40s, the United States was led by an administration that was planning seriously for war. The FDR administration believed that there was some kind of conflict coming with fascism that would ultimately involve the United States. They massively increased defense spending and took other measures to prepare. They also supported American friends, for example, England after the start of the Second World War, robustly. In ways that advanced the American interests, but also in ways that avoided what we see today, for example, with the Biden administration's support of Ukraine, where there's a lot of over-the-top rhetoric, maximal rhetoric, And then the actual follow through on the provision of arms has been documented so well by FDD scholars like Brad Bowman and Mark Montgomery, is much less, it's underwhelming. So that's one difference. I think we have a less serious leadership elite in the United States today. And the other difference, and I want to be respectful of the time of this program here, but I could go on at some length of this, is that no one knows what this war is actually going to look like if it comes, if there's a war in the Western Pacific with China. We see hints on the battlefield about how things are evolving in places like Ukraine and Gaza right now in terms of unmanned vehicles, things like that. But is this war going to look like a large scale clash in which all instruments of national power are used pretty rapidly? So is it going to look like something like World War II, but with 2024 technology? Or is it going to be more limited in space and an objective and look a little bit more like the wars of the 18th century, which did see regular direct great power clashes for limited objectives with limited means? No one knows the answers to these questions. If it's the former, we've been talking about this issue for several minutes now, and I haven't mentioned nuclear weapons. Things get very dangerous and very bleak very quickly. It's an incredibly dangerous time, John. I don't know. I'm curious to know your view. I mean, I don't remember a year that has felt as dangerous in my life, certainly in my adult lifetime, that I've been paying attention to things. Maybe it felt it that way a bit right after 9/11. But the scale of things is so much bigger now in terms of the risks we run.
Oh, I definitely feel that way. And I mean, maybe the only other thing that I would point to is the beginning of COVID and the uncertainty that we felt at that time. And that was just a big, great unknown in front of us. But here, I think it feels more stable in that sense. But then you've got these new wars that have erupted. And what's actually more alarming to me is that even when we see dangerous developments, strategic shifts, it barely seems to register in terms of headlines. And all the while, I feel like we're backsliding into a place that you and I would like to avoid. Aaron McLean, I want to thank you for joining us today. Hope you come back another time on the FTD Morning Brief.
Thanks for having me, John.
Okay, here's what FTD has on tap for you today. FTD CEO Mark Dubowitz was recently in Israel meeting with dozens of officials on Iran's expanding nuclear weapons program. He joined one of Israel's most revered journalists, Alana Dayan, on the storied radio channel known as Galei Tzahal, or the Waves of the IDF, to discuss Iran's nuclear program and why Israel needs to regain focus on this dangerous threat. FTD founder and president Cliff May sat down with Matthew Kronig and Dan Negrea from the Atlantic Council to discuss their new book called We Win, They Lose, Republican Foreign Policy and the New Cold War. In truly hilarious Cliff fashion, FTD's supreme leader summarizes the book as Ronald meets the Donald. This episode of FTD's Foreign Policy podcast unpacks the similarities and differences between Reagan and Trump foreign policy and what it would take for America to win again. And finally, FTD's research fellow Ivana Stradner has a new piece in Kiev Post lauding French President Emmanuel Macron for the principled position that he's taken in the defense of Ukraine. Ivana and co-author Jason J. Smart explain how Macron has transformed into a leader on this issue. He certainly seems to be thinking about his legacy with his second and final term ending in 2027. That's it for today, folks. Read our expert analysis on our website, FTD.org. Read our quick takes on X at FTD and support our work with a tax-deductible donation at FTD.org/invest. Tune in Wednesday for another episode of the FTD Morning Brief. We've got Jason Brodsky from United Against Nuclear Iran rescheduled and ready to go. We'll talk about Iran, Iran, and Iran. See you then. I'm Jonathan Schanzer, signing off for FTD.